welcome to World Apart. Britain may still call itself great, but as its empire deflated and international weight decreased, its approach to geopolitics has become increasingly petty, especially when it comes to Russia. From the spy wars of the previous decade to the current egging on of the Ukrainian war, what does London get from making Moscow an enemy? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Robert Skidelsky, Professor Emeritus of Political Economy at Warwick University and member of the British House of Lords. Lord Skidelsky, it's a great honor to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's good to be with you.
Now, earlier this year, you addressed the British House of Lords, inquiring the government what their Ukraine policy was. What's your own answer to that question?
Well, the official line has always been that Britain will support Ukraine to do whatever it takes, and that is, whatever it takes for victory. And they've never really altered that. They become somewhat more pragmatic, and they've toned down their rhetoric a little bit since Trump came to power. But that has been the official British view. We'll give them all the weapons, all the financial and military support they need to defeat Russia. And they've always referred to Russia's invasion as a full-scale invasion, contrary to international law, which must be defeated, or else the Russians will seek to conquer the whole of Europe.
Now, the situation in Ukraine may seem stalemate to distant observers, but it's been on a constant escalation trend to the point where the current UK government publicly announced a change in their military posture to combat readiness, and the authorities are now talking about building nuclear shelters yet again. Is this still a mostly rhetorical build-up, or do you think London is truly preparing for an active conflict?
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult at this situation because the dynamics of the whole thing have changed since Trump became president of the United States. And obviously Trump wants a negotiated peace. And I've been in favor of a negotiated peace ever since the start of the conflict, virtually. A negotiated peace done with between Trump and Putin, and maybe even forced on Ukraine, would leave Europe out and Britain out. And so Britain's tried to make itself more relevant by heading a sort of commitment to escalation in Ukraine by ratcheting up its the quality and quantity of its military support, in the belief that that will bring sufficient pressure on Russia to settle on Ukraine's terms rather than on Russia's terms. But to my mind, that's a pie in the sky. And as you rightly say, Oksana, it risks escalating the conflict out of control.
I think we should not underestimate this rhetorical buildup because 4 years ago, the war between Russia and Ukraine seemed absolutely unimaginable to the citizens of both countries. And I think one could make a case that it came about precisely because the people in the positions of power ignored all the warnings or took them as, political theater rather than, an astute geopolitical challenge. And I guess my question here is whether you think that the same scenario could repeat itself now on the continental scale.
Yeah, I think the rhetoric has been very, very prominent and distracting. I think the rhetoric, the Russian positions have not been regarded as genuine. In other words, the complaint about the eastward expansion of NATO, the complaint about the promises that were betrayed are all regarded as excuses for the longer-term aim of the Russian government and President Putin in particular of expanding Russia back to where it was in the Soviet Union. So that's a sort of expansionist aim. And Ukraine is simply a proxy war by simply a proxy for these wider ambitions. I think that's the way the British look upon it. Therefore, they look upon all Putin's pronouncements as rhetorical, essentially, either to buy time, or weaken Ukraine, or weaken the West, or something like this. They will not attribute anything genuine to Russia.
That's an irony or a tragedy that may turn into a true disaster. And I think the Russian side has been very meticulous about sending its very detailed and clearly worded warnings. I don't know if you had a chance to see the latest interview, Sky News interview of the Russian ambassador to the UK, in which he very politely, but at the same time, quite resolutely issued a warning to the UK that, you know, the British side needs to uphold the so-called strategic stability, that is the balance of, you know, nuclear forces that has been agreed among nuclear powers. Do you think British take it seriously? Do you think they take the concept of strategic stability seriously? And do you think they account for it in their overt and covert foreign policy?
I hope the pragmatists in the British government are sufficient, their voices are sufficiently strong to not to act on the, not to act on the rhetoric. Because in fact, I mean, Britain has been guilty of goading the Ukrainians on by making promises which it really had no intention of fulfilling. And that, to my mind, is almost criminal, because its outcome has been hundreds of thousands of lives on both sides. Ukraine should have settled in a compromise very, very soon after the invasion. And there was a chance of doing this right at the beginning of the war in March 2022. And I still believe that NATO, in the person of Boris Johnson, visited Kiev and said, don't agree to a compromise. We will support you whatever it takes. And that, I think, was critical. And it amounted, to my mind, to a war crime.
Well, Lord Skidelsky, as horrible as this conflict has been so far, I think the Russian side is trying to send a warning about it potentially escalating to a whole new level, especially if Russian strategic nuclear forces are threatened or damaged, as has been in this latest Ukrainian attack, which the Russian side believes may have been coordinated with the British forces. And I think that's exactly what the Russian ambassador in his interview with Sky News tried to express, that, you know, we may be engaged in various local conflicts, you know, Russia and Ukraine, or as the UK was in Libya before, or the United States in Afghanistan. But up until recently, there was this unspoken understanding that as the nuclear powers are trying to engage or trying to pursue their foreign policy, they try to do that without getting into a direct confrontation with one another, because that may necessitate a much more impactful response. And I think the Americans, by and large, abide by this agreement. But what about the British?
The danger is very great. I mean, of course, the British and the Germans are supplying Ukraine with advanced, with strategic weapons, with weapons capable of hitting targets inside Russia, well inside Russia, as we've learned in the last week or so. That invites retaliation. And so you get into this tit for tat. And then once you have a big Russian retaliation, then the pressure will be on a Ukrainian retaliation. And these Ukrainian efforts are actually coordinated with NATO. And not only in terms of logistics, but also in terms of weaponry. There you have a big danger. And that's what's got to be broken. I think Trump wants to break that. I'm a bit disappointed, at least in our understanding that that President Putin actually says, why should I negotiate now? Russia's got the upper hand. If it carries on the war a bit longer, it will defeat Ukraine decisively and therefore be in a position to impose its own terms on Ukraine. Now, I think that's a bit dangerous. I think also it fails to take advantage of this new dynamic coming out of Washington, or fails to take sufficient advantage of it.
But Lord Skidelsky, let me challenge you here a little bit, because I think Russia has gone out of its way to exactly, you know, avail of this new dynamic in Washington. It's been engaged in numerous rounds of negotiations. It has come up with some, you know, goodwill measures like the exchange of the bodies or the exchange of the prisoners. What more could Russia possibly do to encourage the Ukrainians to come to the negotiating table, not with the loser takes all assumption, but rather with the realistic assessment of the battlefield realities?
Yeah, I understand Russia's position. Ceasefires that last for 30 days simply give an opportunity to build up strength to renew the war. So I understand that the Russian position is they want a ceasefire that lasts because it settles permanently the outstanding issues. I think the rhetoric isn't quite right. The rhetoric comes across as the Russians not being really interested in peace until they've been in a position to defeat Ukraine. I think maybe, you know, this is again a question of language. Words have consequences. And as you say rightly, they should be very carefully chosen.
And let me take you exactly on that point, because I think it's all about the subtleties of the language. So from what I understand, the Russian position is it is not to defeat Ukraine. It's to ensure Russia's security interests. Russia doesn't want to take the whole of Ukraine and be responsible for that ravaged society, to be honest with you. But it does want its security interests to be respected and accommodated, because there are no other means diplomatically to have the Western sponsors of Ukraine to respect Russia's very legitimate and honestly existential security concerns.
Right at the beginning, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was an opportunity to build a new security system in Europe, which would include Russia. It wasn't just that, you know, the answer wasn't just to expand NATO endlessly eastward, but it was to actually abolish both NATO as well as the Warsaw Pact and say, okay, this is a single Europe, and we've got to provide for the security of all its members. That road was not taken. There was, I mean, early in the 2000s, I think, there's a story, I mean, good evidence that President Putin asked whether Russia could join NATO and got the reply, well, you can join the queue. Now, the problem is very, very difficult. Obviously, one of Russia's requirements is neutrality of Ukraine. But that doesn't in itself guarantee the future security of Russia, because there, you know, threats other. So how do you build a new security system?
Lord Skidelsky, let's leave that question for the second part of our interview, because for the moment we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Robert Skidelsky, Professor Emeritus of Political Economy at Warwick University and member of the British House of Lords. Lord Skidelsky, just before the break, you mentioned that Ukraine's neutrality in and of itself does not guarantee Russia's security, but Russia is not an absolutist power. I mean, it's not asking for maximalist demands at this point of time. I mean, it's asking for something that could be realistically accommodated. And I'm sure it has other means of ensuring its security that it does not want to publicize before the West. But my question to you is, what would it take for the Western side or the Ukrainian side to, you know, lower down the expectations a little bit? Because at this point of time, we have no consultations, no negotiations, precisely because the West demands on everything that it wants to be met with no questions asked and no Russia's concerns accommodated, despite the fact that the balance of power does not favor that kind of stance.
I think you need to distinguish between the Europeans and the Americans under the new government of America. I think the new administration, the Trump administration, is actually much more sensitive to Russia's requirements than the previous one, and much more sensitive than the Europeans are. So I think in principle, Ukrainian neutrality has been accepted by the Americans. I mean, that's officially stated. So that's one requirement. Then there is a question of the forward deployment of weapons, which is another Russian requirement, and that NATO deployment, that hasn't been accepted. That's to be negotiated, but it could conceivably be negotiated. The problem of the territory is still an open one. I don't think the Americans have fully accepted. They've accepted Crimea, but not the Donbass. And there is, and the Ukrainians are insisting on full territorial preservation of full territorial integrity. It's one of the weaknesses of the international structure that no peaceful means exist for altering frontiers in line with demographic changes, religious facts, and ethnic facts. The frontiers are regarded as sacrosanct. In fact, Ukraine only in its present form only existed since 1945. Now, there should be some changes of frontiers, and I think that would strengthen Ukraine as well.
Now, you mentioned a minute before that we have to distinguish between the Americans and the Europeans, but I also want to bring in the British position as a factor in and of itself, because British policy towards Russia has been hostile not just for decades, but for centuries. And it is pretty clear that Britain on itself will not go head to head against Russia. But within NATO, as a member of NATO, it's been playing a pretty provocative and at times very sinister role. And it's hard for us in Moscow to determine whether Britain is using NATO to get at Russia or whether it's using a conflict with Russia to get more prominent within NATO. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the British position is mysterious. I find it. I find the degree of British bellicosity, you can put it that way, or hostility to Russia, puzzling. I think it is, as you said, it goes back to the great game of the 19th century. There's a sort of kind of imperial reflex. And there is also a kind of moral outrage. I mean, moral outrage at Russia's what's called full-scale invasion. So those things combine to make Britain by far the most bellicose of the NATO members, even more so than the United States, where a diversity of opinion was allowed. In our country, there's been no diversity of opinion at all. I'm one of the very, very few allowed to speak in England on, you know, anything contrary to the official view, and only in very restricted outlets.
Can I ask you about this imperial reflex? Because, Sure, Britain is no longer an empire, so its imperial reflex may be like a phantom aim. But back in the imperial times, it wasn't just a rhetorical tool. I mean, imperial aims were a practical means to getting more resources, to getting, you know, better ends of deals, to having outsized international influence. In this, at this point of time, what does British influence amount to, or what can it potentially be converted into? Because I do not understand what this hostility with Russia gives to the British public or even the British establishment.
Britain pursued imperialism via the United States, by a special relationship. It was a vicarious relationship, and Britain had to stay clear, had to be near the United States, by the United States, in whatever the United States did. Iraq is a very good example of that. Then there was Afghanistan and so on. But of course, now it's in a mess because the United States seems to be drawing away from its NATO commitments to reset its relations with China. I mean, that's a classic sort of game of divide and power. If you can detach Russia from China, then you will have achieved, America will have achieved a strategic aim. But that leaves Britain in the limbo, in a void. So what it tries to do now is to increase the relevance of a European-based NATO. And so it's been in the forefront of demanding the rearmament of Europe. Of course, that fits in with what Trump wants as well. But the bogey here is Russia. So you emphasize the need for rearmament by saying that Russia has made war on you and you have to respond. And that is the present line, both of United Kingdom and of Germany.
Well, speaking of that, in the current state of European politics, Britain is indeed seems to be on the same track as Germany, which has already started its rearmament despite, you know, a long time history of legislative obstacles to that. How do you take it? Because historically, militarizing Germany didn't bode that well for the rest of Europe, including Great Britain itself.
Again, it's insensitive. Merz is insensitive, I think, to the Russian reaction to a German rearmament. I mean, not I mean, but by rearmament, I mean rearmament almost not with all the whole of NATO, but on its own, leading it. I think it's very dangerous. I think the whole rearmament project is full of dangers. It's an attempt not just to pay its fair share of NATO costs, but to give NATO a European role that is not identical to America's. In other words, to make European NATO more bellicose than American NATO. That's fraught with danger.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are a world-renowned expert on John Maynard Keynes, a famous British economist. And in one of your articles, you suggested that this drive for rearmament may have actually, you know, economic calculus behind it. You refer to it as, I think, military Keynesianism that could provide a geopolitical justification for economic measures that would otherwise be rejected on neoliberal grounds. Do you think that could be a viable economic option for the EU? Because at this point of time, it seems to be far more energized to pursue a conflict with Russia than to address its long-standing economic and fiscal difficulties.
Well, you see, the European Commission has already set the ground for this military Keynesianism by allowing European members to break the fiscal rules of the community in the name of security. So that's the first thing. If you beat the security drum, all other arguments, economic arguments, become secondary. The nation is at risk. The nation is in danger. Any kind of policy that improves the military strength and its added deterrent power of the nation is then justified. But of course, this is wrong. And the premise is it's the wrong premise. Russia is not an immediate pressing threat. It's not a question of either you rearm or you learn to speak Russian, as the Secretary General of NATO just said. I mean, that is simply, it's rhetoric, dangerous rhetoric.
And yet, Lord Skidelsky, if I may be the devil's advocate here for a while, you yourself wrote in one of your articles that the Keynesian policy was born in war, not at peacetime. And for a while, it seemed to be very successful or very efficient in terms of abolishing unemployment, both in the UK and in the US during the Second World War. It allowed the American economy to grow up to 15% or 17% annually in the early 1940s. So it sounds like a good recipe for sort of economic revamping, does it not? I mean, wouldn't that make World War III an attractive economic opportunity?
Yeah, but you see, that's a cynical use of Keynes. I mean, Keynes was nothing. Keynes himself was very hostile to war. He thought that these public expenditures should be directed towards improving the social welfare infrastructure of the country's concern, not spent on piling up weapons. I mean, that to him would have been a false way of securing full employment. He was against war economies. I mean, Keynesianism has been then suborned to the purpose of a war economy, defending a country against its enemies. But that wasn't its original purpose. You know, people, governments have known how to spend money on war. They didn't need Keynes to tell them. And once you know, once you believe that you're in a warlike situation, then all the taps are allowed to flow again. You can spend what you like, you can borrow what you like, you can neglect welfare as much as you like, because security then is at the top of the
But
top
Lord
of the
Skidelsky, the problem with that point of view is that you can lower that due diligence bar only for a while, and then the problems keep boomeranging back within your own society. I mean, it solves a problem for a little while, but it creates far greater dangers, which, again, may necessitate a major continental conflict to be, if not resolved, then at least, let out. But let's hope it won't come to this point.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's Russia's problem as well. Russia's now on a war economy, and it's very successful, but in the end, it's not going to work for the best. So this is a good Russian incentive to make peace.
Well, Lord Skidelsky, I totally agree with you that it's in Russia's existential interest to put an end to this war as soon as possible, provided that Russia's existential security concerns are also accommodated. Anyway, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
It was nice. I appreciate your asking me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.